You're listening to The World Is Just a Book Away podcast. I'm James Owens, founder and CEO of The World Is Just a Book Away, a nonprofit organization on a mission to promote literacy and education by developing libraries and programs in disadvantaged communities around the world. For more information about The World Is Just a Book Away, please visit www.wijaba.org. That's WIJABA.org. My guest today on The World Is Just a Book Away podcast is Leon McCarron. Leon is a Northern Irish author and filmmaker. He is a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society and specializes in storytelling via long-distance, human-powered journeys. His latest book, The Land Beyond, about walking 1,000 miles from Jerusalem to Mount Sinai, is out now. In our conversation, Leon and I discuss what inspired his life of adventure, his 1,000-mile walk through the Middle East, slowing down to experience life and story more fully, and the role reading plays in his life and magnificent journeys. We're here today with writer, filmmaker, traveler, and a man who walks a great deal, Leon McCarron, who's joining us from London. Welcome, Leon.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. I have in front of me your book, The Land Beyond, which, as we were chatting back and forth via via email, I told you I finished recently. It was a fascinating read. And I want to start off by saying Leon and I met at the Festival of Literature in the UAE about, what's it, Leon, about a month ago?
Yeah, something like that. 6 weeks, perhaps.
6 weeks. And time flies. And I saw his book, and I immediately knew that I wanted to talk to him because the title really captured me. The Land Beyond, 1,000 miles on foot through the heart of the Middle East. Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So the title and subtitle, I suppose, give quite a bit away, but about 3 years ago, I walked from Jerusalem in, I guess what you might describe as a large loop around the Dead Sea, which took me north through the West Bank and then down the length of Jordan on the eastern side of the Dead Sea and the River Jordan, then across the Sinai Peninsula, and then back up through southern Israel to get back to Jerusalem. And the idea behind the journey and therefore the book was to look at this area that we think of as the Holy Land, but in a contemporary sense, and to see what it's like now, especially for someone like me who grew up familiar with the place names and the stories from there, but had never been. But also to see how the experience of traveling there on foot in a place where the history is very much carved by footsteps and by walking, how that changed the experience and changed the types of stories and types of interactions that I had.
Beautiful. One of the things that really, well, I have to say, Leon, the first thing that really struck me after finishing your book is I had a great deal of empathy for your feet.
Yeah, many people say that. My feet actually ended up in pretty good shape, probably due to having done a few sorts of journeys like this in the past. And this was actually one of the, and decidedly so, I mean, that was part of the purpose. This was one of the, I would say, the least strenuous of those types of journeys. So my feet ended up in pretty decent shape, which was a blessing in many ways.
Well, you say that now, but at times the way you describe it in your book, it just sounds like your feet were practically torn apart at times.
I suppose, I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about travel and about memory and the ways in which those intersect is that it's very hard for us to remember the specifics of pain and suffering. We might just remember a general sense of misery here and there. But in journeys like this and experiences like this, I tend to forget completely the hardships, especially when it wasn't really the point. And I write about it a little bit because I think it's truthful and it's accurate, and it's a useful representation of that visceral side of the journey. But it's funny that people who read it often bring that up, whereas my memory of the journey is just of everything else.
Yeah, well, I think because most of us don't really have a sense of what it takes to walk 1,000 miles. How long did that journey, and the journey was Israel, the West Bank, Jordan, and am I missing anything?
And the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt.
Sinai, which is Egypt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And back to Jerusalem. How long did that loop take you?
It took about 6 months, 5 to 6 months, which is, that's a pretty, I guess, fair time for it to take. That wasn't rushing too much. It wasn't going too slowly. I kept up a decent speed, a decent sense of energy, but I wasn't pushing through. The point was never to be particularly fast. It was almost quite the opposite.
I like from your biography, Leon, that it says, Leon has been exploring the ways in which moving slowly and thoroughly affects the stories that we hear and tell. His idea is that by approaching storytelling at 3 miles an hour, new narratives and meaning and are perhaps afforded more time to experience and disseminate a deeper human condition. And that's really the lasting impression I got from your book of, which I think was very present when we were together in Dubai, which has grown and developed at such an accelerated rate, that you really slowed everything down. And you really describe beautifully the prose and through bringing forward the characters of your connection with people through walking, through slowing down the pace.
Yeah, I think slowing everything down fulfills a lot of different criteria for me. One, in a very selfish way, is that I just find it's very beneficial for me in terms of physical and mental health. I live in London. I write and I make films and I give talks and I do many other things that are the job aspect that pay the bills. But all of that tends to be done at not 3 miles an hour, but 100 miles an hour. Life is very fast paced so much of the time, especially in a city like London. And I often just feel like I'm constantly running at full speed and in danger of burning out. So the luxury, the great privilege of just being able to go somewhere and slow everything down to walking pace, including my own thoughts. That's just a wonderful thing to be able to do and incredibly relaxing and cathartic. But in terms of the storytelling, I think it's that was the reason I began to experience this, was it just felt to me like any type of deeper experience or interaction, or anyone who claims to want to represent a place or a people or a story, there's only so much you can get by flying through or by parachuting in. And the writer Paul Salopek, who's on this wonderful journey for National Geographic at the minute, walking in the footsteps of our ancestors from Ethiopia out across the world, he's coined this phrase of slow journalism, which I think is really wonderful and sums up a lot of what I've been trying to do over the last few years as well. Particularly, I think by walking, by being as the storyteller or the journalist or whatever title we want to give it, the writer, by being vulnerable, by being on a similar plane, by playing to people, by showing that openness, by, I suppose, walking alongside people shoulder to shoulder rather than turning up in another sense, it just immediately creates a deeper connection than might otherwise appear. And so I've never found anything quite like it for finding out more about the types of places that I'm trying to discover.
One of the things that struck me, and correct me if my or adjust it if my perception is not correct, but the impression I took away from reading The Land Beyond is that you really found it seemed like you found more connection with the people who were living in more humble experiences and more difficult, what many people would perceive as being more difficult experiences. Did I interpret that correctly?
Yeah, I think that's a fair interpretation of it. I guess there's probably two reasons for that. One is that I tried to, as I was walking, I was looking for pathways that would take me away from bigger cities and away from more developed areas, because it's just more pleasant to walk in the countryside and to walk through smaller villages and towns. And I was actually following, for a large part of the trip, I was following a series of new hiking trails in the region that are built atop these old pilgrimage routes and trade pathways and Bedouin and shepherd roads. And you feel all these layers underneath. And I guess just by virtue of the types of paths, these small pathways that I was following, they go through humbler places. They are off the beaten track, to use that phrase. But it's also true that, and again, it's hard to talk about it too much without it straying into cliche or seeming trite, but it is true that so often the places I've been where people have very little, they're so much more willing to give. And I find that again and again, and particularly so in the Middle East. I walk through places where there's a lot of very painful history, a lot of suffering, a lot of poverty. And yet I was received not just incredibly generously, but with open arms and with offers of food and accommodation and everything else. So it is I think to walk out into the world, particularly so into the humbler parts of the world, is an experience that very much shows you the best sides of humanity and shows what I believe is a sort of innate willingness to look after one another. And that's, again, one of the great privileges of being able to do this. And then I therefore feel it's also a responsibility to write about, to, especially in this day and age, where it can sometimes feel like parts of our world are being pulled apart or pulling themselves apart to the edges and to extremes. It's useful to be reminded that there's a lot still out there to be thankful for and to give credit to humanity for.
And I think that was one of the strongest impressions, that certainly one of the strongest impressions I got from this book, was that you not only did you walk 1,000 miles, but you walked through territory that many people would associate with being among the most, certainly so many conflicts and potentially very dangerous. Were you afraid at all, or when you started to approach it, or during the journey?
Actually, no, I wasn't. And excuse me, I wasn't afraid. And that isn't because I'm very brave or fearless, or hopefully not because I'm very foolish. It's because I think so often there's a gulf between the reality of the safety and security of a place and also the representation that we might get from a distance. And for instance, somewhere like the West Bank, of course, is a very volatile place. It can be a very volatile place. It's a place where there is much suffering. There's an incredible amount of hardship there. But it's it's not inherently a dangerous place. And in fact, I would argue quite the opposite. It's one of the friendliest and most welcoming places I've ever been. And I suppose as a traveler, let alone as a writer, it's our responsibility to try and understand the differences between that. And of course, I would keep my wits about me. I would follow advice from people who knew much more. I would keep an eye on local news to see where there might be flare-ups, and there are regular protests which can sometimes erupt into violence for one reason or another. I would stay clear of those, but just walking between villages in this way that I've described is just a very peaceful, holistic process. And I find this all over. I mean, much of my work in the last few years has been in places that are ostensibly seen as very dangerous. I've been in northern Iraq and indeed in southern Iraq and on an island between Yemen and Somalia, which is a Yemeni territory. I mean, even where I come from and grew up in Northern Ireland can sometimes be seen, and certainly in the past was seen as a ostensibly dangerous place. But I think it's very useful to try and break down these preconceptions or misconceptions and show another reality of what it's like there.
You certainly did that. I'm curious, because I know that you cycled 14,000 miles from New York to Hong Kong and walked the length of China and have ridden across Patagonia on horseback, among other adventures. What launched you in on this path in life?
It's a very good question. I don't really have a concise answer for it, but without dragging it out too much, I suppose I grew up in the countryside in Northern Ireland. I always appreciated that. I was always interested in people and in stories. I've always been a great reader, I suppose, and I was always brought up with books around, and so the idea of being a writer or of finding ways to tell stories in that way was very appealing to me. And then after university, when I graduated in 2007, 2008, there was a global recession, and it didn't feel like the best time to be trying to launch myself into some sort of more recognized career path. And so I did what many people do, which is to take a year and go off and do something else just for oneself and give a little bit of mental space before reassessing. But that was when I bought a bicycle, moved to New York City and set off west across the US. That journey then kept going for a year and a half, and I ended up in Hong Kong. But along the way, I realized very much that the slower I went, the more I saw, and the more I looked outwards rather than inwards, the more interesting it was for everybody. And after that, I set off on this journey to walk the length of China from north to south, which is about 3,000 miles. And I did that with a friend. And that was because we'd both at separate times ridden bicycles through China and were just fascinated by this new global superpower, but one which the China that we'd seen on bicycles was so different from everything else that I'd read and looked at through mass media and through other interpretations. The China that I saw was so different from Beijing and Shanghai and Hong Kong and Guangzhou. It was a place where, you know, still more than half the population lived in the countryside and were still at times using almost medieval farming methods to plant rice. And it was just such a huge, vast and interesting place to me. And so when we did that, we were very fortunate to get commissioned to make a 4-part TV series. And I also wrote about that in a sort of long form way, not in a book, but in long form pieces. And from that point onwards, it just didn't seem like there was any going back. What I wanted to do was to get to know places and people in a deeper sense, to get to hone the craft of telling those stories, and in a selfish way, to be able to just enjoy this experience of seeing what an incredible, diverse, complex, wonderful world we have.
And what message do you think we can all, our general listeners, people you talk to around the world who don't have a calling or the fortitude to walk 1,000 miles through a place, what message do you think you can share with people that you've learned that they can apply in their lives?
I think a very obvious one is to slow down. To slow down and even in this, you know, we live in an age of immediacy in everything from news to transportation, and we can tend to feel like we're so much better connected because we have these amazing smart devices in our pockets that can connect us to any point of the world at any given time. But in other ways, it seems like we're becoming less well-informed or more polarized. And I think a lot of those issues that we're facing, both on a personal level and as societies, can be solved by taking a little bit more time, slowing things down, slowing down the way we think, slowing down the way we interact and try and understand one another, and using that as a basis for life. And of course, we have all these wonderful technological advancements, and I use them all, but to bring everything down to maybe not always to 3 miles an hour, but a little slower is very useful. And I mean, we're in danger of losing or missing how important human connection is, because we're so reliant on technology these days. But a walking journey, I enjoy walking 1,000 miles. Not everyone will, but what I can report back from that is that there is nothing that teaches you more about the world and more about yourself than meeting hundreds or thousands of people face to face and looking into their eyes and getting to know them and getting to trust them. And I think the more we're able to do that on a small or a big level, the better our world will be.
I want to really honor you for sharing that message, because I'm sure, as you're aware, in London, the same as here in LA, you just mentioned people looking into each other's eyes. And I'm actually quite saddened by how often I see people walking around and not even relaxing while they're walking, because they're looking at their phones, or at the dinner table, they're looking at their phones and they're not looking around or looking into people's eyes.
Yeah, I mean, our time is being eaten up by this stuff. My phone now tells me every Sunday how much screen time I've had each day of the week, and sometimes it can be terrifying. And I think of how many hours I've been awake each day, and then what percentage of that has just been taken up in one way or another by looking into the screen. And even for someone like me, who preaches this message and is theoretically aware of the dangers of it, it can be very pervasive. So I think it's a big problem for us all. Or a challenge for us all, let's say.
Well, switching gears or shifting gears a little bit, as you know, my book, The World is Just a Book Away, really is about people traveling the world through books. That's what my life was about before I had the opportunity to start to travel. Can you just speak a little bit to the importance that reading plays in your life?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's I think it's commonly acknowledged that anyone who writes should read voraciously. Reading is the best way to become a better writer. And I'm very lucky to have grown up in a family and in a household where reading was always highly valued, and there was always books around. and I was always encouraged to enjoy that. And That was the way in which I learned so much about the world, and also in reading was the way in which I learned to interpret emotions and scenarios as well. I think when you're growing up, and especially in teenage years, so much of what goes on in life can just be incredibly difficult to interpret, and I really felt like reading helped me in that sense. And And at times it's been escapism for me. At times it's been comfort. At times it's been inspiration. But I feel like most of the major events in my life, personal and the work that I do, are somehow related to books that I've read at the time or as a result.
Given that you spend so much of your life on the, well, on the quote unquote, on the road or on the path or on the bike, and you have to be very conscious of weight, how do you read while you're traveling? Do you read on a Kindle? Do you carry a book with you? Or are you just too tired to read when you're traveling like that?
No, I generally do take books with me. On long walking journeys, I do have a Kindle, which I've used. I think I got that probably for that journey through China in 2011, and I used a Kindle on the Land Beyond journey. But it's not quite the same. But it is a way to get through a few different books without having to carry the extra pounds, which really do mount up. And I think it's a fair compromise. I'm not too precious about it. I can live with a slightly digital version of reading for a few months at a time.
Can you think of a book that you could share with the readers that our listeners that they might not have read, or that they might have read and revisit that particularly touched you in some way in your life?
Well, I suppose there's a number. I always say that when I was in my teenage years, I read a number of books about, I suppose, what we might call some of the greats of exploration and adventure. People like Shackleton, Ernest Shackleton, who set off to Antarctica and had the most incredible adventure, and I use this word with much consideration. It was an incredibly heroic journey that he ended up going on, not at all going to plan, but he managed to handle a very unfortunate situation in the most remarkable way. So I read his book South, which detailed that, and I also read Wilfred Thesiger, who was a British traveler who set off across the Empty Quarter, the largest desert, the largest sand desert in the world, on the Arabian Peninsula. And he wrote very beautifully, not just about the experience of walking across a desert, which is ostensibly quite dull. And I know that because I've done it. he writes about the asceticism that one must adhere to if you're to do something like that, and his odd but very keen enjoyment for that. But he also writes about the special type of hospitality that one finds with people in the desert, the way in which in these places where to sustain life is so hard, the way in which people react to one another and look out for each other. So I suppose perhaps many of the listeners will have heard of people like Shackleton and Thesiger, but their books, South and Arabian Sands, were big influences on me.
Wonderful. And what are you currently reading?
I'm currently reading, I do have a bad habit. Someone told me the other day that it's a very bad habit of reading two and sometimes three books at the same time. I'm reading a book of collected journalism by A.A. Gill called Lines in the Sand, which is really quite harrowing. It's a lot of A.A. Gill was a great newspaper writer in the UK and wonderful journalist, and who recently passed away. And this is quite a hard read, but a very humane look at his journeys through refugee communities. But I'm also, I just started a book called Frankenstein in Baghdad, which I think has got a lot of good press recently and very, very well deserved. And it's, I'm trying to read more fiction. I think this was one of the dangers of being a non-fiction and travel writer is that you just end up reading similar things to what you want to write. And so I miss not reading much fiction. And Frankenstein in Baghdad is this really wonderful reimagining of Frankenstein, but set in Baghdad about 15 years ago. And originally written in Arabic and now translated into English. And so I'm about halfway through that. And it's I'm very, very much hooked. It's the one of the best books I've read in a few years in that style.
That gives me something to think about. I've actually been reading Frankenstein for the first time, Frankenstein itself. Maybe that'll be a good transition for me into Baghdad, Frankenstein of Baghdad.
Yeah, I think so. It would be interesting to read them in close proximity.
Yeah. Well, I know that you are, because we had a talk about this, and I'd never met anyone who been to this island you referred to, Socotra, I believe. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Yes. Yeah.
Socotra, Yemen. And that's part one of the projects you're working on now. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now, which projects you're working on now?
Sure. Yeah. So that's, that's one of them. Socotra is this, very small island that sits in the Indian Ocean in the Gulf of Aden. It's a Yemeni territory, but it's almost 300 miles off the coast of Yemen. It's actually much closer to the coastline of Somalia. It's an archipelago of four islands, and the westernmost is probably only 50 miles from Somalia. But as you can imagine, given that proximity and also just that location in general, it's in a very complicated part of the world. But it's avoided much of the It's avoided all of the war that's the horrendous war that's been tearing the mainland of Yemen apart. And this island's really remarkable because it's sometimes referred to as the Galapagos of the Indian Ocean because of the incredibly high levels of endemism among the plants and animals that are there. And it's not perhaps quite as high as the Galapagos, but it does have the most incredible species there. Something like a third of the flora on the island is found nowhere else on Earth. And so it's this biological treasure trove because it's been so isolated from the mainland. But it also is this really deep and interesting cultural heritage too. It's always for two millennia it's been this stopping point in all of those maritime trade routes between India and the Middle East and into Asia. And the frankincense trees on Socotra have always been famed and were taken and sold and traded through ancient Egypt and Greece and Rome. And on the island now, there's the Socotras who live there have their own language, which is no written form. It's vaguely related to some other Southern Arabian languages, but it is completely distinct still, and it's certainly very distinct from Arabic. And so much on this island is just remarkable and unique, and yet it's also under threat. It's despite the island having stayed clear of the war on the mainland, there are still geopolitical machinations at play. There are also it's one of the many places that is suffering from a changing climate. And in the last 3 years, there have been three huge cyclones that have hit the island, and the regularity of those is unprecedented. Something needs to happen to save what is there. Otherwise, everything that makes this island so special and spectacular stands to be lost. And I traveled there last year with a small team to begin work on documenting the island, and we hope to go back again next year with the larger scientific team to do a full, I guess, almost health check of the island. And part of my job as a writer and as someone who's been interested in trails and in walking and in going slowly will be to use some of those same methodologies that I've done before of walking the old pathways of the island to start to bring together some of the stories and histories of it. So that's something that's a big part of the next few things I'm doing. I'm very interested in trails at the minute, and I'm actually working on developing a hiking trail in China, in Hunan province. And I like the idea that trails, when they're done well, are almost a way of telling stories in themselves, that you can read. You read the landscape like you might read a book, but you read it with your feet instead of with your eyes and with your brain. So I'm very interested in this relationship between between walking and thinking and landscapes and movement and all of that sort of thing.
Amazing. I love that thought of reading through your feet as one would read books. And I know you're... I know these projects are keeping you very busy, and I really want to thank you for taking the time to join us today and to share your thoughts and the story behind your wonderful book, The Land Beyond. I also have, incidentally, I haven't read it, I just got it. I have The Road Headed West next to me also, your other book. So I'm looking forward to reading that. And I just want to ask if there's anything else you'd like to share with our listeners.
I can't really overemphasize how important reading has been in all of these different ways that I described a little bit before. And the one other thing I would say is that I've traveled to all of these countries, well over 100. I've been on all these great journeys and so on. But I would still say probably the most formative thing that has ever happened to me was reading East of Eden by John Steinbeck, and it was shortly after I left university. But there's something about, Steinbeck of course is highly regarded for a reason, and many people found this before, but there's something in that book that just taught me so much about family dynamics and the ways in which people think and understand each other, and it just suddenly felt like I got a lot more of what was going on in the world, and even this, I guess the reason I feel it's relevant to share it here is that even having had the great privilege of seeing so much of the world firsthand and being there up close, it's still a literary experience that I think is one of the greatest teachings I've ever had, and so never underestimate the power of what a book can do.
I can add amen to that. And Leon, thank you so much for joining us today. I really look forward to staying in touch and hearing more about your adventures and your projects.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Leon.
You've been listening to a podcast production of AW360, the year-round content destination from Advertising Week. Visit AW360 at 360.advertisingweek.com and be sure to check out the other AW360 podcasts now available on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and Stitcher. Producers on this podcast are Jack Hirschman and Richard Larson, with music provided by Audio Network. For more information on Advertising Week, the world's largest gathering of advertising, marketing, and technology leaders, now in 6 markets across the globe, visit www.advertisingweek.com.